Coming up next, Robert F. Kennedy's speech concerning the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4, 1968. Martin Luther King was an American clergyman, activist, and leader in the African American civil rights movement. Robert Kennedy was an American politician, Democratic senator from New York, and a noted civil rights activist.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening because I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own deep despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. So I ask you tonight to return home, to say a prayer for the family, Martin Luther King, yeah, it's true, but more importantly, to say a prayer for our own country, which all of us love, a prayer for understanding and that compassion that of which I spoke. We can do well in this country. We will have difficult times. We've had difficult times in the past, but we will have difficult times in the future. It is not the end of violence. It is not the end of lawlessness, and it's not the end of disorder. But the vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to improve the quality of our life and want justice for all human beings. that abide in our land, and what dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people. Thank you very much.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining up with us, we're listening to What is Progress? Author Ronald Wright says understanding humanity's pattern of progress and disaster will help us avoid the collapse of civilization as we know it. Ronald is interviewed by Pia Chotopati.
The other questions, where do we come from? Of course, where do we come from is part of what are we? But where are we going? That is the one that I wanted to address in A Short History of Progress. And of course, nobody can see the future, and I certainly don't claim to be able to do that. But we can look back at the patterns of where we have come from and the patterns of behavior, just as we get to know individuals through our lifetimes, observing how they behave in different situations and getting to know their character by looking at the deep past, going back not only centuries but thousands of years and even back before history and before modern humans, we can get an idea of what the human character is. And the human character is that we're very clever and we're extremely good, innovative, short-term thinkers, but we're extremely bad at foreseeing the long-term consequences of what we're doing, and also extremely bad at limiting our immediate desires for power, for food, for money, whatever it happens to be, for limiting those or keeping them at a reasonable level in order to keep things going indefinitely. We tend to just let things rip until they crash.
You, in your book, speak a lot about two terms, the runaway of change and the collapsing of time. What do you mean by those terms?
Well, yes, if you look at the human voyage over the past many thousands of years, what you see is an enormous acceleration in the rate of change. From the first chipped stone tool, which is getting pretty close to the emergence of the first hominins or people that would lead to us, creatures that would lead to us, from the first chipped stone tool to the smelting of iron took about 3 million years. But from the first smelting of iron to the hydrogen bomb took only 3,000 years. So that enormous technical leap took only 1/1000th of the time. And I think it's pretty clear. You look just within our own lifetimes, sort of anyone who's middle-aged has seen that the nuclear age, has seen space travel, has seen all sorts of things. Which have happened in little more than a century since the first powered flight.
Are you suggesting then that the collapsing of time is a bad thing, or is it just a thing, a shortening?
Well, no, I meant collapsed in the sense of perspective. You know, that as things speed up, then time gets shorter. That's what I meant by the collapsing of time. You know, Well, in prehistoric times, social change was so slow that an individual wouldn't notice anything different over the course of their lifetimes. That the world that they are born into is the same world that they would leave when they died. And it's really only in the past 100 to 150 years that social and technical change, or if you like, progress, maybe, has begun moving at such a pace that, you know, we even have a hard time keeping up with the skills that we learned in childhood become obsolete in 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is. So we certainly will not leave a world very much like the one we were born into. So that's what I mean. That's a pretty new thing.
You, in your book, also have this interesting discussion about the anthropological meanings of culture and civilization. And you make a distinction between the two. And I think sometimes I and others mix up those terms. So just explain the distinction as you see them.
Well, culture is everything. Culture is all of the belief systems, practices, art styles, ways of living of any human society. And indeed, we're now recognizing that some of the higher animal societies have culture in the sense that different groups of chimpanzees forage in different ways, behave in different ways, and that this behavior is passed on from parents to offspring rather than being an innate pattern. So you know, culture is everything that we do and think and believe as humans. Civilization, in an anthropological sense, has a specific meaning. And a civilization is essentially a culture or a society that has reached a certain size and scale and complexity. And you don't really get civilizations emerging until after the invention of agriculture, or I should say the slow discovery of agriculture. That doesn't start until after the end of the last ice age. So, you know, the first experiments with farming only go back about 10 or 11,000 years, and they happened pretty much simultaneously in half a dozen core areas of the world. And so beginning about 10,000 years ago, you've got people experimenting with planting seeds and sort of selecting the best ones to plant again the following year. And gradually, gardening develops into full-scale agriculture. Once you have full-scale agriculture, you get a boom in the human population, a boom that has yet to level off.
Okay.
So you get very large societies, and then you get social classes. You get kings, governments, armies, priesthoods, peasants at the bottom supporting it all.
And fast forward,
that is civilization.
Fast forward to today, because one of the civilizations you are quite critical of in your book is Western civilization. What is it about us that we just haven't lived up to our promise?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're necessarily any worse than others. It's just that because of our technological advancement and the very large numbers of us, we are in a position to do much more damage to the Earth and therefore to ourselves in the long run than ones that existed in the past. And the ones that existed in the past that have disappeared or gone through profound changes or collapses, they were localized in certain areas. And, you know, if they destroyed their environment or wore out their welcome from nature, as most of them did, there were other places where new civilizations could arise. And the overall experiment of civilization, I consider it an experiment. It's an experiment that the jury hasn't pronounced on yet. The overall experiment continued. But what we have now, it's not that I'm sort of singling out Western civilization to say nasty things about. What we have now is essentially one big world civilization, which is using the same technological means. It's exploiting everywhere. It's taking fossil fuels from everywhere. It is polluting everywhere. It is fishing everywhere. It is cutting down forests everywhere. So there are no sort of untouched, pristine natural pockets left where a future civilization might arise if we don't succeed. You know, all the bets that our ancestors placed when they invented civilization in different parts of the world, these are now all resting on one big high-stakes throw, which is the future of world civilization.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Hard to do. imagine no possessions.
Back to Ronald Wright, who was interviewed by Pia Chattopadhyay.
And you suggest that we have been caught in what's known as progress traps through time.
Well, yes, progress traps. That was a term I coined to look at things that begin as very successful and seductive inventions, discoveries that seem to be beneficial, but which can lead, when they reach a certain scale, or a certain intensity, can lead to a catastrophic end.
Give me an example.
I'll give you a couple of examples. One is that even before the invention of civilization, the Ice Age hunters at the end of the Old Stone Age became so good at hunting that they actually ruined hunting as a way of life. They were, instead of, you know, just figuring out a better way to kill two mammoths instead of one, they were driving whole herds of mammoths over cliffs, which meant they ate like kings, but it wasn't long before no more mammoths. Our ancestors are the survivors from that failed experiment or that progress trap. They're the people who found that they, after hunting rabbits for a while, they discovered farming, which was something they were only able to do because the Ice Age had ended and the climate had stabilized. So that's one. But then when you move into the early civilizations, you look at the Sumerians of what is now southern Iraq, they made a wonderful discovery, which is irrigation. And so they could start growing crops all over extremely arid, flat land. And for a while, everything went very well. They kept leading more and more water to this thirsty land. The fields under cultivation got bigger and bigger. The population grew. The cities got bigger. The kings became more powerful and so forth. But what they didn't know is that that kind of irrigation leaves salts behind in the ground. And over centuries, the water was evaporating in the hot sun, the salt was staying in the soil until they actually poisoned their land. And when you look at pictures from southern Iraq, from the recent Iraq war, you see some of those ancient ruins standing in an extremely desolate landscape. It's just brown, maybe it's a little white and powdery and dusty. That earth has not recovered from these catastrophic farming practices, which began as a very seductive and successful discovery. That is a classic progress trap.
But you, throughout your book, you have so many examples of progress traps throughout the history of time. I'm wondering, doesn't it just seem to me anyway that then civilization itself is a progress trap?
Well, yes, I think it is. I think we have to ask ourselves that question, that it could be a progress trap. And our job here, the beginning of the 21st century, our job is to make sure that it isn't a trap. In other words, we have to take what's good in our civilization and use that to build real progress, something that can last, something that is indefinitely sustainable, and thereby avoid falling into the trap of burning up everything we can lay our hands on for a sort of short-term binge, which seems to be what we're doing at the moment. We have to get away from that and put our civilization, which is effectively the whole experiment of civilization, on a long-term, stable, sustainable basis. And if we can do that, then we have escaped from the trap. But right now, we don't know if we're capable of doing that.
You write that food technology of the late Stone Age is really the only technology we cannot, as humans, live without. And, you know, even Gauguin was spent so much of his time not just surviving but creating. So I'm wondering, I mean, isn't there value, or shouldn't we put value into inventions that aren't quote-unquote true progress?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm a great admirer of civilization. I want the experiment of civilization to succeed, and I want to see genuine progress. I just happen to believe that as our technologies get more powerful and as we become more and more numerous, and we are living at a higher and higher level of consumption, so the footprint of each individual human is also growing, in fact, much more quickly than the population. But as we do these things, we're putting everything at risk. We are threatening our very survival, and certainly the survival of anything we would recognize as a civilized way of life, by not thinking things through and by not constraining the forces of greed and short-term commercial profit and military power and so forth that threaten to bring us all down, as they have with many of these past societies.
I guess the conundrum here, though, is that we often only recognize these progress traps with hindsight. So how do we find progress traps with foresight?
No, well, that's the big question you've asked there. Of course, we can't foresee exactly how things are going to turn out. I mean, a more recent example would be the invention of nuclear power and the building of the early nuclear reactors for civilian purposes in the 1950s. And everybody was terribly gung-ho about this new technology and said, you know, pretty soon we won't even need to put meters on people's houses because power will be so cheap and abundant, we'll just, you know, give it away. And everyone thought that was great. Of course, we now know that there is a huge downside to nuclear power, particularly waste disposal, decommissioning of reactors, danger to life and limb, meltdowns, things like what happened at Fukushima. So we could not, in those early days, the boosters anyway, did not want to consider any of these downsides. However, many of them are not that unforeseeable.
Coming up next, Bill Cosby talks on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. Bill Cosby is an American comedian, actor, author, television producer, educator, musician, and activist.
In the old days, you couldn't hook a school because behind every drawn shade was an eye. And before your mother got off the bus into the house, she knew exactly where you had gone, who had gone into the house. Parents don't know that today. I'm talking about these people who cry when their son is standing there in an orange suit. Where were you when he was two? When he was 12, where were you when he was 18? And how come you don't know he had a pistol? These are not political criminals. These are people going around stealing Coca-Cola. People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cops shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand? Brown versus the Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We've got to take the neighborhood back. We've got to go in there. It's right around the corner. It's standing on the corner. It can't speak English. It doesn't want to speak English. I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is, go wild there. I don't know who these people are. And I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth. Why can't you hit the streets? Why can't you clean it out yourself? It's our time now, ladies and gentlemen. It is our time. And I have good news for you. It's not about money. It's about you doing something that ordinarily we do, get in somebody else's business. It's time for you to not accept this language that these people are speaking, which will take them nowhere. What the hell good is Brown versus the Board of Education if nobody wants it? I mean, this is the future, and all of these people who've lined up and done whatever, they've got to be wondering, what the hell happened? Brown versus the Board of Education. These people who march and were hit in the face with rocks and punched in the face to get an education. And we got these knuckleheads walking around, don't want to learn English. When you go to the church, look at the stained glass things of Jesus. Look at them. Is Jesus smiling? Not in one picture. So tell your friends, let's try to do something. Let's try and make Jesus smile. Let's start parenting. Thank you. Thank you.
And now for something completely different.